Thank you. So, for some reason I have a different screen here. Sorry, I'm a little distracted as usual. I don't know. It's okay. So where we finished yesterday, so some new people here, so welcome, and some old people here. old people meaning people who were here before. So the people who haven't attended, that's fine. I think we'll catch you up to speed or not. Each session is sort of, one way we could say, doesn't stand alone, but because I go through a progression. But it is also something that you could probably plug into, I hope. We've spent the last couple sessions, well, we've gone through a progression, and then yesterday when we finished, we were talking a little bit about the relationship between mind and brain. Okay? And, thank you. I really feel a little bit shy about drinking, and I wish you have a drink. That's good. Okay. You have a drink. Okay. Oh, okay. Good. Thank you. Anyone doesn't have and they want to share with me, that's okay too. I have to share. So we ended with yesterday, we're talking about the relationship between brain and mind, and then I launched into the a little bit about neuroscience and the relationship of the brain to the mind and how we could train the brain and train the mind or train the mind and train the brain. And then there was a question yesterday I didn't answer. Do you remember? Oh, you do. So the question yesterday was about if the mind is, so we went into a definition or a description of what the mind is. So according to Buddhist thought, philosophy, psychology, the mind is formless, okay? The mind is formless, that means non-atomic, okay? Anything that we perceive with our five senses is form. Which was, as a younger person, when I was studying this, and I heard that anything with five senses is form, and I just sort of assumed sound was formless. But as we know now, it's not, right? It's actually atomic, isn't it? Okay, which is interesting. When you don't think about it, I don't think you would think of it as something being atomic or form, what we call form. Okay? Form, now in Buddhist thought, almost everything has a definition because you have to define your terms so that you can have a discussion. So if I'm talking about love and you're talking about love, but we're defining it differently, it's very hard to have a conversation. And that happens a lot, just commonly in the common language. So people say things like, oh, I heard, Buddhism doesn't believe in the soul. Well, it's hard to know. Because depending on what your definition of soul is, right? Now, the way it's typically defined, we don't hold on to that as a supreme idea, the idea of soul or God, depending on how it's defined. Now, so that has a big impact on how we have discussions. We have to be able to define, and everything will have a definition, even form and formless. Okay? So form, not to get too technical, but form is defined as that which has obstruction. Okay? So you think about smoke, well, it's form, it doesn't seem very obstructing, but it is. Okay? In the sense that it does obstruct space. Now, space, is space form or formless? What do you think? Formless, one says formless. Anyone say form? Okay. Is it obstructing? Is space obstructing? What does it obstruct?
Stuff that's in the space, you know, you found an empty space is not really
vacuum. Right.
So it's
the stuff in the stuff. It's separating the other stuff. So you can talk about this book and this cup and there's space. Right? But is that space, if you actually perceive space, is the perception of it, is it of something that's obstructing? When I perceive the cup, we could say it's obstructing, right? What about space? Space is non-obstructing. Non-obstructing. That's its nature. Okay, so is it form? Can you perceive space? Can you perceive space? Hello? Anyway. I know it's after lunch. People are tired. Who say yes, you can perceive it? Okay, I like that. Seems like we're perceiving it, right? Are we perceiving it or are we inferring it? We're actually inferring space. We're seeing space in relationship to obstruction versus non-obstruction. Okay? So, I mean, this doesn't... Why are we talking about this?
The mind.
Thank you. The mind is formless. Okay, so it's formless like space is formless. So it's not obstructed. It's not obstructing. It's obstructed in a way, but it's not obstructing. Okay? So then we say... Where is the mind located? This is the point. Is the mind located in the brain? Now we know not. Now we have a reason why to say no. We have a reason to say no rather than just our opinion. Do you follow me? If it's not obstructing, it can't be located in the brain. That's an that's a containment. I mean, you can talk about the space of this cup. Right, you can talk about it. There is a space of the cup that you can talk about. So, but it's not. How do I say this? The space in the cup is inferred by the cup, but its existence is not from the cup. Do you know what I mean? Okay. Its nature is not from the cup. Maybe that's a better way to say it. Its nature is not from the cup. The cup doesn't create the nature of the space. It's technical. It doesn't worry about it. My point is, the brain, the mind does not get housed, cannot be contained within the brain, which is obstructing. Because if you say it's not obstructing, then in a sense you could say the mind could float through the capillaries and the neurons and the neuropathway, the physical stuff of the brain, right? So when we die, that's why it explains what death is. It helps, not explains what death is, but a little bit, is that, you see what I'm saying? When we die, since the mind's not obstructing, it does abide within this body complex. But it can also... It sticks to it more than about it sticks to this. It's dependent upon it. But when we die, the consciousness, because it's formless, leaves. It doesn't abide in this complex anymore. The definition of death, because everything's defined, is the actual definition of death is when the consciousness separates from the body. That's what death is. Death is not when the breath stops. Okay? Death is not when the mental activity stops, or the brain activity. Okay? It's when finally that consciousness separates from our body. And that death is I don't want to say permanent, but it's final. It's not like the consciousness can go back into the body. So, you know, near-death experiences, this is just my opinion, by the way. I know, near-death experiences, and they say, well, I left my body, and I was looking down at my body. I'm not sure that the entire consciousness left the body. Consciousness has different levels. It's the gross, subtle, and very subtle. When death happens, when we're dying, the gross consciousness, the gross minds, we say, the gross consciousness, which is things like, you know, your afflictions and your emotions and your thoughts, they all absorb. They begin to dissolve into themselves. So they become less pronounced. Not less, but they stop being pronounced at all. That's why, and your functions go. That's why, you know, when you're dying, you lose the recognition of knowing people. And then your hearing starts to go. You can't start hearing sounds. All those gross functions start absorbing. But you're not dead yet, because they're absorbing into the subtle mind. Then the subtle mind's functioning still. Then that absorbs into what's called the very subtle mind, which is tendency located within the heart. It's, you know, abides in the heart, in this center here. Okay? So I think in near-death experiences, your part of your gross mind is outside the body. There's some functioning outside the body. That's totally possible. But I don't think it's the very subtle mind, because if that were outside the body, then that would be death. And I guess, you know, you hear stories that it can come back in, but I don't know. I don't think that's that common. I think it's more of this gross mind. What does that have to do with anything? Yeah.
So are you using the mind and consciousness?
Yes, same word.
Interchanging.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so let's go on. So what are we? Right? Oh, wait. Now, see, it's not working. Okay, we got to figure this out. Okay. Oh, there we go. Probably this thing that says resume slideshow. Yeah. I see. Okay. So when we talk about a person, so now we change tracks. So when we talk about a person, or in this case a person. Person is made up of a body and a mind, okay? Form and mind. Body and mind. Okay? So when we talk about the body, we mean these five senses. Okay? And that's the windows to experience. So when we experience and go through experience, we're doing so through using the senses. Okay? Now, the mind, and if this might be too hard at this time of day, but anyway, we'll try. So the mind, so this is the thing. So we have what we call a primary mind. This mind is the clear one that we're talking about. Remember yesterday? Clear and able to perceive objects. That's the definition of the mind. It's clear. It cognizes. Okay? That's what a mind does. So space is clear, but doesn't cognize. So it's not a sentient. There's no being there. There's no experiencer there. Okay? Mind's experience. That's sort of what a living being is. It experiences. Okay? When you're in a coma, are you experiencing or not? When you're asleep, are you experiencing? Do you remember it? How about when you're in deep sleep? How about when you're in a coma? So is the mind functioning when you're in a coma? It's experiencing. And I think if you have a very, very heightened awareness, you could be aware in a coma. In theory, it's definitely possible. The reason I say that is because there is a quality of mind that when we develop our minds good enough, that we can experience the entire death process. All the absorptions. So you see, where we live now is totally in the gross mind. We think that's all there is. You know? And I'm generalizing, but, you know, that's, you know, so we think, you know, the whole world is nothing but what we experience with the five senses or six senses. And so we're really blind to this whole other different levels of experience. So when we become more attuned with those other deeper, more subtle functionings of the mind, levels of the mind, then we can function from those states of mind, very, very subtle, and have very different qualities than this gross one, which is this gross one's kind of, it's, you know, when you think of, when you think or look at it more, the gross mind is very immature. It thinks that, oh, this is the world. There's all life.
And that's this one, primary mind?
So the primary mind, well, that's, okay, so primary mind is the mind that that's the primary mind. But the primary mind, what we're talking about here is we have, the primary mind has six, we could say we have six primary minds. Don't think of it so much as six independent. It's like almost minds functioning. So one primary mind sees things. It sees. Okay? So what I mean to say is we have those five senses. Okay, so if we have an eye sense, do we see things? If you have an eye sense and you don't have an eye consciousness, do you see things?
No.
To see something, do you see something only with your eye?
No.
Because otherwise you could take the eye out and put it there and it would see things. Right? And this gets important in a minute. Maybe it's important already. So in order to see things, you have to have a mind. And that's what we call the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose or sound, smell consciousness, depends how you want to label it, but okay, tactile consciousness. The tactile consciousness cannot see things. Okay, the tactile primary mind cannot see things. The eye primary mind cannot feel things. Okay, that's why they're listed as six separate. The sixth sense or sixth mind is the when if none of your senses are functioning, are you dead? No. Because what about when you're thinking of stuff? Or imagining? Or dreaming? How's that happening? None of the senses are functioning, correct? That's the sixth sense, what we call the mental sense. Okay, it's a little confusing because it's also related with the mind, but for the sake of function, it's like a, so like when we're dreaming at night, and I dreamt last night my youngest son was like 3 years old. Where does that come from? And he wasn't, and I wanted to go play golf, but he was a little bit sick. And I was trying to think if I just, put him to bed, and go play golf. Am I going to get in trouble? My wife? Yeah. So I didn't go. Okay. I got to the conclusion, well, that's really the right thing to do. Because your desires are... Anyway, I don't know where I get that stuff either. So that experience, even though I saw some colors, was not my eye consciousness functioning. Okay? Or my eye organ functioning. It was all mental sense functioning. Okay? That's perception. So that's what your mental sense does. Yeah. Okay. So that's what the... So this thing is really weird. On my screen, I don't see that. So body, mind. We're body, mind. So body, we just think of as five senses and these limbs. Okay? The carry. And then mind is you think this. Okay? For now. Yeah, it's not changing up there. So what happens in perception is like, okay, so what happens is to have an experience, you need a consciousness, you need a sense organ, including the mental organ, and you need an object. Okay? That's what experience is. Raw experience. So see, that's kind of, now we're going to get into a bit of the problem side of things, because that's raw experience. When we talk about how we don't see reality, and we'll talk about it more a little later, think of this diagram or this function. So when I'm looking at you guys, or you're looking at me or whatever, and you're hearing, you see how what happens is we create an experience where we're not experiencing this. This is what's really happening. What's really happening is I believe and relate to you out there, correct? If you're like me, do you do that? Okay. But when we look at this diagram, to have any experience, we do need an object, so you're my object. We need a sense organ, so we have the eye. And we need a sense consciousness, which is the eye consciousness. But my experience and my belief is only with the object. Do you follow me? My whole experience is only the object, when in fact these three things are happening. So for me to see you, are you more the object or are you more the experience of my eye consciousness? Because to see you, I have to have an eye consciousness is doing something. It's creating an image of you or reflecting you or reflecting the object. It's doing something, right? But we don't see that. We say, oh, you're sitting over there. I see. Why do we, you know, this is where it's very important. Why do we say, Karen's sitting over there? Why is that my experience? 100%, right? 100%, that's our experience. When in fact, 100% is not our experience. I don't even know what percent of our experience is the object out there and what percent is the mind creating the mental image that's engaging with. We don't even relate to that, do we? We don't have, I'm generalizing, you might have, but generally speaking, people have no experience of that. That's happening in your brain right now. It's happening in your mind right now. Are you aware of that? No. And that's, if you think and just reflect, that's pretty strange. Why are we so hung up that all reality is objective? Objects. Even subjective reality, this gets really fascinating. Even we say, well, no, you know, I have subjective reality too. And I say, what do you mean? And you say, well, you know, I can see that I'm upset. I see I'm confused. So it's not all just out there, it's in my mind. But even perceiving those mental things, we perceive them objectively. We don't see them as dynamically. It's a dynamic experience, not a static one. Now, if you really, when you really study and you really, most of you probably know this, but just to reiterate, your experience right now is not dynamic. It's static. You might see things moving. I understand. But your experience, do you follow me? Your experience is static. You're seeing things as if they're frozen, even though they're moving. Conceptually, we're not seeing the movement. I mean, not conceptually. Directly, we're not seeing the movement. Just conceptually, we can agree on that. Well, wait a minute. I saw your hand just move. The way you saw my hand move was in a completely incorrect way. The way you saw my hand move like this is these little flashes of staticness. They're just happening really fast. When we really see impermanent or movement, it's not like that. It's like it's just like a river or a cloud going by. You know, when you see the mist, experience is more like that than what we're seeing. It's fluid. So if we see this correctly, we'll see it more as fluidity than solidity. Help me out here. Do you see things right now as solid or fluid? How many say solid? Yeah. Uh-oh, not everybody. How many see this as a fluidity? Thank you. Maybe if people see it as fluidity, they might not say, because the nature of the reality of our experience is that it's fluid. Also, another part of our experience is that it's mental. How much of this is mental, what you and I experience right now, and how much is objective? Opposite of objective. What do I mean by mental? That's a good question. Not physical. Well, let me take a little further. When you say, what do you mean by mental? That should be obvious because that's our experience. You know what I mean? Isn't our experience, a lot of it, mental right now? And then we could have a little discussion about how much of it is mental? How much of it, you know, first of all, I'm going to make an assumption that none of us see much of a mental experience here. What we're seeing is I see you sitting there with your, you know, orange blouse and your tan pants and your red hair. So I'm relating to you as out there, aren't I? But really, all of that must... Didn't we discuss yesterday how color... Where I heard that there is no color, out objectively. That light waves have no color. Is that right? Anyone know? I heard that. That the color is constructed within the mind. I mean, I believe that. I wish someone knew for sure. But I have read it. You know, I'm not much of a science person, but I like reading it. So if that's true, then we're all seeing a lot of color right now, aren't we? And we think it's out there. I think that Donna's blue blouse is right over there, don't you? How many of us see blue Donna's blue blouse over there? We all do. But if there's no blue there, just as an example, this is from Buddhist psychology, goes much deeper than that. But just let's take the color. So the color is hits the sense organ and is somehow constructed within the mind, brain and mind, isn't it? That's what I've heard. Someone do research on that, please. So we think it's physical, right? But now we just discover all the colors mental? That's pretty interesting. Why does it matter? Does anyone have that question? I hope they don't. Why it matters is because then we're living in a world of fantasy or not reality. And if we're living in not reality, then we're interacting with it's as if, you know, we're interacting with like illusions or hallucinations. That's kind of concerning. Now, remember yesterday I told you hallucination is not exactly the right word because hallucination means not there at all. Well, there is something here. There is some sort of something there in Donna. Just what we're interacting with isn't there that way. And people go, well, that's pretty weird. So what? You could say so what, right? The so what is because what we don't know is the absence of that or the dealing with the real situation is a state of being that's far more blissful, happy, joyful. It's just another world, another universe, literally. That's absence of problems, absent of problems, absent of suffering, absent of confusion. Absolute ignorance. And of course, normally we say, what do you mean? So what? But when you start getting in touch, that's why we talked about first having some familiarity with what Buddha taught in psychology as the truth of suffering. Because otherwise, yeah, so what? You don't even know, we don't even know suffering. A dog, you know, those dogs eating that? I mean, do you want to wake up tomorrow morning as your dog? Forget the dog. Everyone goes, why do we always think about pets? Pets are statistically unmeasurable in terms of the animal realm. There are 14 trillion mosquitoes in Alaska during the summer. So pet animals don't even measure in terms of the animal realm, do they? I don't know how many barnacles there are, how many plankton there are. They're all sentient beings. You know, so why did I bring that up? Someone? Oh, right. So what if you wake up, you think, so we look at the dog. I mean, the dog, okay, the mosquito is not thinking it's suffering, right? We assume, we just have to fantasize. We assume it's not thinking I'm suffering, or your dog's not thinking I'm suffering, right? But we look at it and go, God, I'm so thankful I'm not like that. So our condition right now is also could be looked at like that. That's the point. So if you could somehow shake your dog or cat into seeing that it's kind of in a messed up place, you would want to do that. So that maybe it could change it. If it had the ability. Well, we have the ability. And we're being shaken, but we don't. We say, so what? I want to go to the fair. It's fun. I want to have a successful career. That's really important. Not that we shouldn't. I'm just saying. Sorry, we go on these soapboxes. You know that. Okay, so when we so there's more that goes on than just primary mind. That's unfortunately. So we're having this interaction. So remember that those three things: consciousness, sense organ, object. But that doesn't stop there, unfortunately, because that's very. If it was just that, everything's sort of neutral, isn't it? It's just data. You know, it's not a. So when I'm just in that realm of experience, I don't have anything like. You know, I don't like this coffee because it's too cold. Do I? It's just data. But it never stays as data for us. It never stays as prime experience, raw experience. Not at our level. We can do that. Don't need to do that, but you could. So what happens is we have a sense, we perceive something, and always, there's five things that are always accompanying every experience. That's the bummer. Or the good thing, I guess I should. It's one of the things that always happens is we have a sensation, we experience a sensation. No matter what. Even we're not aware of it. Most of the time we're not aware of it. So when I look at Donna's blouse, I also, not only is this raw material, you know, reflected on my mind, immediate, same, next instant is a sensation. Okay? And there's only three sensations, and you can't have all three at once. You can only have one at once. Okay? And those are the... So when you're looking at anything or hearing anything right now, you're having a sensation of agreeable, neutral, disagreeable. You might not... Probably not aware of it. Okay? This is where we're talking about human experience. Now, you could be aware of it, too. Like, you hear some loud noise. Oh, you know. Right? The sensation and the recognition happen at the same time. But a lot of times we're not recognizing the sensation. Okay? Okay, that's just what I just experienced. So that's what we call experience. That's what experience is. And that's happening 24/7, every day of your life, and past life, and future life, and in the intermediate state when you die, and in the womb when you get reborn. All the time, this is going on. Okay. Now, again, if it just stopped there, it doesn't. Excuse me. Okay. There's some people studying in Robbie's class. Anyone? Yeah. So this is this stuff. Okay. The 51 mental factors, we could say. So when. Okay, so we have that sensation. That's a mental factor, by the way. And then, does it stop there? Does it stop there? So I lift up this cup, I take a sip, and it's cold. Okay, so the taste organ, my tongue, an object is the coffee. Consciousness is the... In this case, a taste consciousness is registering that experience, correct? But it doesn't stop there. Then there's a sensation, isn't there? And so it's either a sensation, you experience a sensation, but then it doesn't stop there. We always interpret. So there's some kind of sensation, agreeable, disagreeable, or neutral. And then, due to all my past history, so this is where it gets really kind of, I don't know, problematic. Because then I say, you know, God, why did David give me cold coffee? Right? Is that what we do? Why is the guy driving slow in the fast? Does he know it's 45 miles an hour here? You know, why did my partner have to put me down in front of all her friends? I mean, didn't she know that was rude what she was saying? Okay. Why is my manager not like? It seems like never make him happy. I'm trying all I can, but he's just always got this attitude. That's all. So if you back up, Where that all started was just what we did a few slides ago. It's experience. But we never stop there. We then go into interpretation. Okay, I hate cold coffee. Right? I don't like cold coffee. That coffee's too strong. That coffee's too weak. We do it all day long. All the time. Every instant. Okay? So that, what happens is that due to past experience, habit, those neural pathways we talked about yesterday, then come into play. Somewhere along the line, I don't know, I developed this idea that hot coffee was better than cold coffee. Not only that, but then we have these kind of mental disorders, these afflictions, like anger and attachment and greed and jealousy, and those get stimulated based upon habit. Like some people just don't have much jealousy. Okay? They still have jealousy in their mind though. But they haven't strengthened that mental neural pathway, that mental habit. That's good. We're trying to reduce those because they cause problems. So the bigger these things, the reactions are, the bigger that's what we call a problem in Buddhist psychology, okay? That's very different than in the normal world when we say the problem. Okay? Got it? So all of that, now you back up a little bit, I say, you know, well, it's because, remember we talked about blame? It's because David took so long at the coffee shop. Otherwise, you know, then we create this whole reality. Is any of it real? And that we call life. That's pretty pathetic. It really is. So my life now, what life means is how much I can have things go right, according to my stuff, and avoid what's going wrong. Isn't it? So if I can just get my universe organized in such a way that the right things are happening more than the wrong things. Isn't that what our life is about? Yeah. So when you look at it that way, what do you think? It's more of a rhetorical question, I guess. But doesn't that look sort of sad? Can we get life, can we get the external world to come in line, into line? Yeah. Why do we keep trying? Now, it's one thing to do it without, it's okay to try and get the external world to come into line if you know you're not tricked. Because that's just improving things for people. That's good. Especially if people don't have the capacity to think about things like, or right now, like we're thinking of. So don't get me wrong. You just let your house go to, you know, just rot away. But it's the attitude that goes with it. You're not tricked anymore in thinking, gosh, you know, a new coat of paint is going to, that's what's going to work to make me feel good again. Okay? That's generally how we do things. Gluten-free. You know, it's like we think finally we've discovered gluten-free. But don't you think there's going to be something else in 10 years? All of a sudden it's going to be, I don't know what it's going to be.
5 years.
5 years, 3 years, 2 years. You know what I mean? It's like we think that computers, amazing computers, and we think, well, there's not going to be anything else like that. I mean, I think intellectually we'll go, oh, there probably will be. But I'm just saying, instinctively, the way we go through our life, we think this computer is, you know, so, it is amazing. But, you know, we go to the computer thinking it's exists like it appears, as something that's perfect. And then when your hard drive crashes, it seems so, you know, it seems unusual, doesn't it? Oh, it's the company. You never buy these, whatever, Dell computers. They all crash. It's not, it's because we invested in this conception that somehow external world can be perfect. I don't think there's one, can you think of any perfect external thing? Huh? What's
my pickup truck? No.
Yet we go to everything as if it's perfect, don't we? I mean, that might be a gross generalization, but that's generally our attitude, is when we're approaching things, they're perfect until they're not. But when we first get it, or we first come in contact with it, when you're walking up to the coffee counter, you're hypnotized, I am too, that it's a perfect, going to be a perfect experience. And then all of a sudden they tell you, we don't have any decaf. It happens all the time, but sometimes we think that's an aberration. Okay. I keep doing that. Yeah. So if you think about these questions, what really bugged you today? Can anyone have an example? Did anyone get bugged today by something? I know, no one did. Yeah.
The traffic for the fair.
The traffic for the fair. Okay. Good example. So, if you think about that, we could say, I got really irritated by the traffic today. Can't you? So, in light of what we're up to today, what really happened there? It was an accumulation of all these atoms and molecules and mental. Now, the mind, the primary mind's clear. So it's not even. So it's just that. That's all that happened. There was this stuff in front of you, right? In your experience. How did you get from that to the traffic really bugged me? That's this other slide. That's that one. Now, with training the mind, it actually happens that you're just in awareness. Can you imagine if you went and from the moment you got in your car to the moment you saw the first car of traffic that you were just in bare awareness? Would it have been different? Just bare raw experience? Okay. So I have to ask everyone, why didn't you do that? And you can ask yourself, why didn't you do that? What happened? We always do, right? You come in contact with the object, maybe a car or a stoplight. It's just red. It's just data. It's not even red because we've discussed that we don't even know where the color is. But we get tricked into thinking the traffic's out there. That's the problem, right? Problem is they did the fair during when I was doing this class. That's the problem. Okay? So you have to think about problems. But the point is, I've been struggling with that for a long time. Then we get into the I. We haven't talked too much about that. We won't go there yet. But just see how this is labeled a problem. Right? The traffic, we really believe, is a problem. Maybe that's one thing that really is in the universe. But anyway, we really believe the traffic is a problem, right? If the traffic were the problem, you know those guys with their little flags out there for you to park? Do they see the traffic as a problem? No. But we go in saying it is a problem, truly existent problem. It exists the way it appears. Its appearance, traffic, exists that way as a problem. But if it did, then everyone would see it as a problem, correct? Why don't we? What's going on there? What's wrong? So that leads to a lot of mental disorders, doesn't it? Next thing we know, he's out of his car and with his tire iron banging the guy in front of him. Basically, it's not that big of a step. All based on an incorrect view, correct? You see what I'm saying? Yes.
And I've heard from somewhere, it was either Lama Zopa Rinpoche or Geshe-la or somebody, that we could turn it around and think, oh, look at all these people, they're going to the fair, we should be so happy for them because they're going to do something that they want to do and have fun.
Yeah.
And be happy.
Anybody watch sports? Good. Baseball? Okay, football. Yeah. I had a really interesting experience. I mean, it sounds simple, but for me it was very profound. So I'm a lifetime Dodger fan because I grew up outside Los Angeles. My mother was fanatical. So the Dodgers are now in the playoffs and stuff like that. And I was watching a game the other night, and I never had this experience. I had this experience intellectually, like you were saying. But I actually had it perceptually, which I think many people have. Many people have much better equanimity than I do. But I was watching, the Dodgers were winning. They turned the game around, like they were behind the whole game. And I'm kind of like, oh, you know. And then it turned around like in the ninth inning or seventh, eighth, something like that, right towards the end of the game. And then they're showing pictures of the Cubs fans and the Cubs player. The Nationals, Washington Nationals. And I had it without thinking. I felt really sad. I felt like I'm one of their fans. I could jump back and forth. I'm so proud of myself because generally in sports, you don't do that. My wife does that, and it bugs me. Because, like, you know, the Dodgers and the Giants will be, and she's like, oh, well, no, that's too bad for the, I said, no, the Giants, we hate the Giants. It's okay. You know, but I was very pleased that I, and so, yes, that's what, and when we get to those level of teaching, I'm not covering that in this, you know, in this seminar, but when we talk about the meditation on equanimity, that's exactly what happens. And at first we do it in a contrived way. Like, oh, well, think about all the people going to the fair. Think of the poor National fans, right? But there is a point where it's just natural because that is more aligned with reality. The other one is not as much further from reality. Okay? So I agree with you, yeah. That'll come as we become more familiar. Yeah, so we already did this in a sense. Where is the problem located? But you have to. This is a situation where we should be doing this as people are trying to become more and more aware. Do it all the time. So it's first thing is we're really out of tune with is that it's a problem. So your example of the traffic, you begin to start saying, okay, this is a problem, at least in your head. Okay, in the way that it's not the problem. There's a traffic. The problem is I'm irritated or I'm something. We have to begin to see. And what happens is that every instant, as you become more aware, you see as a problem. And that's a good thing. I'm not saying, you know, you suffocated like, I don't know, Larry David or something. But, you know, it's where you're, you see it as a problem or suffering, whatever word you want to use, without the depression that comes with it. It's almost like you're kind of excited about it. Because finally you're seeing it for what it is. In a sense, it's a problem because we set ourselves up for it. It's not a problem if you're not set up for it. You know, Geshe-la might be driving in your car with you. It's not a problem, correct? Because of his mental attitude. Okay. But I think it's very important to be honest with ourselves and begin to see that most of our mental attitude is problematic. And not be guilty about it, not be down on ourselves. You know, it's an opportunity. Finally, I get it. You know. Finally, I get that this is problematic. Why? Because are any of us in a state of bliss right now, which is more about our natural right or a state of clarity? Okay, I can say, no, I'm not. Okay, good. This is a problem. I don't like the word suffering. I gotta, you know, that's, but it is suffering because I'm not fully happy in a way that's true happiness. Okay? So the suffering is really not being truly happy. So someone might be in your car and the traffic's irritating you, not irritating me, but I'm still in suffering, okay? Just to make that clear. Because I'm still not in that happiest state, blissful state of mind that of clarity. But it's less, in a lesser state of suffering, we could say. But still, it's problematic. Yeah, so it would, but one last, but the point was, oh, to locate the problem. So we're both stuck in traffic. One guy's irritated, one guy's not. And we turn to each other, we say, well, this is problematic, isn't it? And I'll say, yeah, even though I'm not irritated, yes, it is problematic. Because the problem for me is I'm not seeing it correctly still. I'm still in a kind of a gross state of experience. And then he's irritated with the traffic. So at his point, we're both trying to locate where the problem is. So if you're irritated in traffic, and in a way it's kind of easier to locate the problem than if I'm not irritated, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? If you're not irritated, we get to the point where it's still a problem because I'm not seeing reality. Still seeing it falsely. To me, for me, that's still a problem. I want to see things correctly. I want to see reality. I want to see that traffic how it really is, even though I'm not that irritated. Okay, do you follow me? Okay. So then you, just so I get this thought out. So you have to notice, okay, so what is the real object? So in the car, I'm just extrapolating, you know, you're saying, well, the problem is a stupid fare, right? That's something we'd say. Okay. Now, if we begin to look at that dynamic of perception, that's what I'm asking you now, locate where the problem is. Where's the problem, you know what I mean? Now we start looking at the problem is I'm not seeing it correctly. The problem is, you know, my mental emotion of attachment to having things go right. You know, I don't like this lack of control, things like that. So you locate it more and more. Ultimately, the problem is this false sense of I, misconceiving who we are. Misconceived identity. If we conceive the identity correctly, there's no problem with the traffic. Because there's no one to be problemed. The only reason we're irritated by the traffic is object, subject. So now we start turning the problem, the blame onto the subject. I. Okay, there's an I there. If you're irritated with the traffic, there's some I there. Irritated with. This irritated I. Irritated traffic eye. And that eye is completely misconceived and doesn't exist that way. That's the best way to kind of get rid of the problem. To start blaming that conception. You had a question first, right? Sorry, Dave.
I'm trying to understand.
Mm-hmm.
I'll probably understand as you teach, but if we are seeing people killing each other and
mm-hmm.
people being hungry,
uh-huh.
floods, that's really happening, right?
Is it?
So how...
How do you mean really happening?
Well, we see. We can... We have the statistics, we have the visual.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to see it
mm-hmm.
and hear it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reality.
Well, go back to where we were. What are you seeing?
I see people dying.
Mm-hmm.
I see people shooting, killing.
Mm-hmm.
I see people hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Those really affect me. So.
Of course, yeah, they affect me too.
So how can I think it's just my perception when it's really...
Oh, I see. Well, first of all, I didn't say it's only perception, did I?
That's why I'm following through the lecture.
David said, I asked the other night, what percentage of our experience is mental? Yes. And I think David said 100%. And I said, well, I have to talk to you about that.
I didn't mean to say that.
Answering that question, by the way, which dovetails into your point, is not an easy answer because there's different interpretations by even the deep, deep philosophical schools. We have four philosophical schools. And those four philosophical schools defined experience in how much it's mental, purely mental, and how much is something out there. They all define it differently. That's how they're distinguished from each other. Okay? One of the highest schools, but not the highest, says it's all mental. Which you can see how you could say that. If you take our example up here a little further, what of my experience can I prove is not mental? So take Donna, for example, again. So I see Donna there like you see Donna there. And I see her body. And I see the color of her blouse and her skin tone and all that, right? So the color and the shape and then the sound, where is that being experienced, really? It's been experienced in my mind, isn't it? I can't see Donna without a mind. And as you begin to deconstruct it, I could see that everything, like all of you right now, is all mental experience. Can you see that? It could be. That's what the Chittamatran school says, second highest school in Buddhism. Very profound. Very, very profound. And experiences reality, emptiness, more and more, you go through those, so you will see things as a meditator, as a spiritual practitioner, meditating on reality or emptiness, the same thing. We should say emptiness of inherent existence. That's the right way to say it. Not just emptiness. Emptiness sounds like voidness or like some vacuum. It's not. Emptiness has nothing to do with a vacuum. Emptiness has everything to do with you need an object. Okay, it's not devoid of an object. It has an object. So if you're meditating, and you start, well, not just meditating, but meditating too, you can begin to see, you watch your experience. And then you could see that even with your eyes open, that the experience is all moving across your mind. It's all mental. Are you following me? Because I don't want to be too vague. Can anyone see that? Anyone disagree with that? That you might not be able to distinguish whether it's all just mental? If color, for example, if color is experienced in the mind, then a lot of what I'm seeing experienced right now is color, isn't it? And shape. How can I prove that you're out there? How can you prove out there all those kids are being shot and killed? Or whatever, whoever's been trying to, violence. No, so go with me for a minute. I don't mean to be, what's the word, insensitive, but just for the philosophical sense, okay? We cannot find where the violence is out there. Now, I believe that there's something going on. We should protect people. So I just want, that's my qualifier. But for the sake of philosophy, where can you prove to me that that violence is happening? Other than mentally. But how about that? Can you prove it to me? Yes. Back there? Uh-huh. Wait a minute. You can. Okay, good.
Yes, I can prove that the violence is happening when I see someone dies and is dead in front of me.
Uh-huh.
Now, the difference is...
Yeah, I can prove that there's violence and uh-huh. There's someone that is dead in front of me. The difference is how it's affecting me. Yeah. And that's where I can change. Is this dead going to make me sad? Is going to make me fear? Is going to make me angry? Mm-hmm. And that's where I can change. How the event is affecting me.
Yeah.
But that there's a dead body in front of me and I have seen it. Yes.
I'd like to go a little deeper. That's what I'm saying. So can you go with? I'm with you. I'm a regular person too. So I get it. You know, I'm not saying, oh, you got killed. It's just your mind. I'm not saying that. But I am saying let's be provocative. Okay. Let's just provoke our thinking a little bit. So if you take your experience, I get that. But where in your experience, even seeing his dead body bleeding out on the sidewalk? Where is the objective reality in that? How do you prove it to me?
Well, from the mental point of view, there's not objective reality because everything is perceived by different minds. So
right.
it wouldn't be an objective reality. It would be always a subjective reality.
Perhaps.
Because you're perceiving the event in one way, me too.
Right.
So there's no objectivity, really.
Right. Right. So that's the point. Now, by the way, when you get to the highest school of Buddhism, just so I relieve people's minds, they do talk about some kind of objective reality, but how it's talked about is a bit different than how we're talking now. But nonetheless, you know, they don't, because if it's all just subjective, when Buddha attained enlightenment, we all should have become enlightened. Because we were all just mental projections of his. but it didn't happen, did it? So there's some kind of objective reality, correct? You know, this is what the philosophical schools are discussing. How is it that there is objective reality? And I won't go further into that because it's a whole school class of its own that takes months and months and years and years. But what I want to go back to what you're saying, both of you are saying, is just to have the question about what, where does the subjectivity end and the objectivity begin, is all assumptions that's in the world, the common world. And I'm just saying, let's provoke that. We don't really know, do we? We don't really know. It's as hard and bad as it is, and you know the person looks like they're suffering. But we have to have, what we're trying to do here is add suspicion, doubt, which really means introspection. So I think that the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, are totally against that violence. Okay, so let's start from there. But I do think that they're seeing it, not the way I see it. Not the way you and I are describing it. So how are they seeing it? Now, I'll add one thing to it. I think they're seeing it how I'm talking about, actually. Very subjective. But what's the difference? This is how I come to terms with it. So it's illusory-like. It's dream-like. They're watching, you know, it's all dream-like. Is the reality of the situation is it's more like a dream. They're like, we say this is not a dream. But how they describe reality is this more like a dream than like what we're seeing. Now, so this is really, really important, okay? Otherwise, what your guys are challenging, which is accurate, is a kind of a nihilism. Oh, they don't exist at all. Kill them all, right? And we know that nihilism is an extreme that we don't adhere to. What I'm arguing, or not even arguing, what I'm trying to impress upon you is the other extreme that we generally live in, which sometimes you turn to as positivism or eternalism. That's where we live 99.9% of the time. So I want to throw that into question. So in throwing it into question, it sounds like, oh, we've got to be careful and don't go into nihilism. Like nothing exists. Those kids on this, whatever example you're using, kids don't exist. They're just an illusion. That's not true either. That's an extreme. So how do they exist? That's what we do an inquiry about for years and years and all our life. Okay? Just so you know. But don't. What I'm trying to get here is start questioning. Don't go in with those, you know, Trump is bad or Hillary's bad. That's the same thing. You know, we have a hard time finding Hillary out there, isn't it? Or Trump. It's hard to find when you really introspect. You know, you go, okay, where does Hillary exist objectively? How does she really exist? Or Trump really exists? Very confusing. They don't exist the way that we're all talking about them. I can tell you that. They don't exist the way we're talking about them. And that's how all the problems in the world start, by a misperception. A misperception of how people and things are. And so, I think because I like being provocative, if we're going to say it's a misperception of how Hillary and Trump are, then we have to say it might be a misperception of how all that violence is and that killing and that. I mean, you can't just say some is real and some's not real. You know, it all is the same. So how does it exist? But I will tell you, I told a story the other day. You may be familiar with Milarepa, the great yogi of Tibet. He's a hero of Tibet. Great biography. You've never read it. Really fascinating, really inspiring. His teacher, Marpa, was a lay person and very, very, very wrathful with Milarepa, very rough with Milarepa and his students. And Marpa's son, Dharma Doge, was meant to become the heir to Marpa's lineage. Marpa eventually, his lineage, evolved into the Kargyu school of Buddha, of Tibetan Buddhism. There's four Tibetan schools, Nyingma, Kargyu, Shakya, Gelu, and his of the Kargyu came down from through Marpa. So one day, Marpa's son fell from a horse and cracked his head open and died. You know, was killed. And the story goes that Marpa broke down and was really weeping and crying. And his students are standing around, disciples standing around, kind of, some of them started being a little perplexed. And finally, then they asked Marfa, they said, why are you crying? You told us it's all just an illusion. So he's crying. Okay, that's my point. He turned and said, it is all illusion, but this is a super illusion. Meaning, you know, there's still conventional reality. There's relative reality. And at the very least, if we're talking about violence, you know, that person believes his or her suffering is real and it really hurts. So we have compassion for that. Even if they're seeing it wrong. Doesn't mean we're not compassionate. Doesn't mean we don't relate. Okay? So of course we relate. But I think that we have to be courageous and start investigating our assumptions, our assumed way of seeing the world. And when you see reality, actually your heart opens more. Okay? So it's not like, I think they have a stronger reaction to violence than us. But different. Not with attachment. Because they see it how it really is. And it really is very painful for people, and people believe in that pain. So of course they have compassion. Does that make sense? You know, I don't have all the answers. That's just how I see it. You were going to ask something?
Yeah. It's probably a simplistic question, but it's you know, when you're talking about Geshe Gelug being in a traffic jam, uh-huh. You know, say he's coming here,
yeah,
and he's in a traffic jam and he's not worried about it, or he's happy, or because he sees things differently. Well, what if he had 200 people here waiting for him to teach to, mm-hmm. and then it's almost like the tension of being in a traffic jam would encourage him later to avoid the traffic, so that there's some goodness in that tension. Or if he's sitting there and he's got 300 people, he's made a commitment. How does that? It almost seems like, and this is what I miss, it almost seems like, don't worry, be happy, you know? But yet we have commitments, and the tension or the problems in the past help us to avoid, like, you know, maybe they should have avoided the traffic. You know, so I kind of get hung up on that.
Well, I heard a couple questions in your question, but I think that for me the most important one is Geshe-la in traffic, or us in traffic, and he's thinking about there's 300 people here, and normally we'd get anxious and, you know, whatever, anxious.
Yeah, anxious.
Yeah, so... number one, if we see the situation from the point of view of how it really is, you won't get anxious. You can only get anxious because you see it incorrectly. That's one. Now, the other thing is that just by training your mind, and maybe you don't see reality, that's the best way, but, you know, we're all at our individual levels. At least you're sitting there, I mean, this helps me a lot. Is you begin to reflect on your state of mind. Mindfulness, okay? So, the only reason you get anxious is because for me, it's probably I'm worried about my reputation. Reputation of someone, some identity that doesn't exist, for example. I get hooked, I get tricked, and worry about it. And we all know this. So anxiety, nervousness, you really begin to see it doesn't help. You're really in the moment. You become much more in the moment. You're with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, there is only the moment. And in that moment, I don't even know what that is, honestly. Because, you know, the whole goal is to have a happy mind. So nervousness is not a happy mind. So I'm just talking on our level. On our level, why get anxious? Our job is to be happy. So it's a habit that we would get anxious about being in the traffic, and there's nothing you can do about it. Why do we do that? Why do we get... You know what I mean? I understand.
If you don't get anxious, if you're in a moment and it doesn't affect you in any negative way, then maybe next time you're not... Who cares? I mean, who cares if you make the class? Who cares if you set up a class? Or like you, and you're not here. You didn't come. I mean, why? From your perspective, it really wouldn't matter.
Well, you know, what we're talking about is values. And so being available for the 300 people in our conversation is the ultimate value, right? That determines good and bad. That's actually what you're saying. And for the spiritual practitioner, that isn't the highest value. So I've been waiting at teachings at Lana Medicine Buddha in California, where I live, and Rinpoche's house, Lama Zopa Rinpoche's house, is nearby. And I've been waiting there for hours, and he didn't come. And then we get a phone call saying Rinpoche decided not to come. What value is he working on? Right? He doesn't value us all waiting there for teaching. Isn't that the highest value? It's not the highest value. Even that's not the highest value. You know why? It had been raining, and there were too many worms on the road. And he didn't want to kill all the worms by driving there. Another time, my wife was driving him home during the rain, and the last part of his driveway is pretty long. I mean, it was whatever, 100 feet, 200 feet. And they had to get out of it. It was pouring rain. And they had to get out of the car, leave the headlights on so they could, she could pick up all the worms on 100, 200 feet. So they wouldn't run over them. Not just her, but he and Rinpoche, a few other people. Can you believe that? So what's the value there? Is the value, don't get wet, you might get pneumonia, don't get home on time. All those superficial, I mean, those are not, our values change. So the value there was kindness. Human life. You see? If Rinpoche was just subjective, oh, just run them over. They just say, oh, they're all in your mind. Okay. It's more complex than that, right?
And doesn't it always come back to karma? Like if you're sitting there waiting for your teacher and your teacher doesn't show up, that's mm-hmm. your karma that you're experiencing this.
Well, we're not talking about... Well, we will talk about... Should I keep going on this? I want to just interrupt that about karma. Absolutely. So one of the things we talk about, one thing I've been talking about, and maybe I made a bit of an error, is talking about how reality... So I'm talking about ultimate reality, how things are. But ultimate reality is balanced by conventional reality. Same, they go hand in hand. So in conventional reality, we're talking about karma, cause and effect. We don't see cause and effect. We don't live in that perception. So if we can't, as hard as it is to operate from the point of view ultimate reality, emptiness, you know, reality... another way of saying is what we don't see that is there. Remember Geshe Gelug's quote, we don't see what is there and do see what isn't there. One of the things that's there that we don't see, and we gotta see it and function, is this thing called cause and effect. So karma sounds like a interesting philosophy concept, but it's not just that. It is reality, conventional reality, and we don't see it. It's happened moment to moment. But it's related with the mind. It is a mental... Karma is mostly mental. Thank you. I gotta look up there. Okay. Okay. Here we go. Exactly. So there's three umpires. Having a beer in a bar after a game. And one of the umpires says, there's balls and there's... By the way, I did this in Mexico and it didn't work. They don't know about baseball. I mean, they have baseball, but no one knew about it. So there's balls and there's strikes and I call them like they are. Right? The other umpire says, no, you got it all wrong. There's balls and there's strikes and I call them as I see them. Right? Third umpire says, no, you're both wrong. There's balls and there's strikes and they're nothing until I call them. We don't live in that world, and that is how the world is. Okay? Trump is not bad or good until I call him that. Hillary is not a liar until I call that. Okay? Violence, even you can apply it to violence. Not self-existing that way, okay? It's still relative. That's the point. Even violence is relative. Not absolute. Now, pretty close to the absolute, isn't it? Because it's painful, but it's not absolute still. Okay? That's going to upset my friend in the back, right? So we do have problems, but that doesn't mean we are problems. This is the separation. They ain't nothing until I call them. But generally, we identify as the problem. I'm depressed. I'm irritated. Okay? You know, once it starts changing, you know, about the political landscape, what's happening now is, you know, it's pretty disturbing. And, you know, I'm upset about, you know, what he's saying or what she's saying. But generally what we mean is, I am upset, or do you have upsetness? And I don't want you to change your language, but I do want you to think about, there's a difference between being upset and having upsetness. When you say, I'm upset, you can't really do anything about it, because your identity is fused with the upset. If you have upsetness, oh, you have it? Again, I don't want to, it sounds pretty weird to language it that way, but to think that way, that's more accurate. Or I'm being influenced by upset, or I'm being taken over by upsetness. When I do, in therapy, that's mentioned that I did narrative therapy, that's what the part of the language they offer, because they saw problems as separate from people. I thought, that's great. So you when you language a problem with someone comes in and says, you know, I'm really feeling depressed, and then I'm giving you the short version, and then you say, well, how long has depression been attacking you? And they start saying, well, I've been depressed for, you know, 5 years. And you say, well, when did 5 years ago, when did depression introduce itself to you? And slowly they start saying, yeah, well, that depression, you know, it came when my son returned home from Iraq. Oh, really? Yeah, and how did it get a hold of you? I don't know. I guess I didn't listen to its messages, and it just snuck right in. It's beautiful what you get. It's so creative. But they get liberated just from the languaging of it. Now, it's not a big deal, but it is a Buddhist concept. We don't even do that. Okay? So we say the traffic is irritating because we think it's truly existing that way, rather than saying, I have irritation from the traffic. Can you imagine if you said it? I mean, that sounds weird, but just bear with me. What if you said, I have irritation from the traffic? Isn't that so much more accountable? Can't you then do something about it? Yeah.
I think people say that all the time subconsciously. I mean, we're already programmed and conditioned.
Which way?
Traffic, and it's a bad thing. People worry about traffic before they even leave the house.
Yeah, say it again
and
now.
They almost like manifest, the problem people manifest.
Right.
And they think every problem.
Okay, so stop there, right? Mm-hmm. So before they even leave the house. So what's going on?
It's a, you know, it's a program that's been, you know, people have been conditioned.
Feeling,
thinking.
Right.
I mean.
And if you said to him or her, you knocked him on the head, you know, and said, oh, do you see that you're doing that? Hey, oh, what do you mean?
You're crazy.
You're creating this movie, we haven't even left yet. But they think that's reality.
Mm-hmm.
They believe it's true. The traffic is really out there waiting for us to get caught by it.
When they think this, and, you know, they create it, they manifest. So he probably essentially. Did you worry about the traffic before you even left the house?
Sometimes I do, but not today because I have forgotten about the
good thing. But what you're describing, that mental process, is happening all the time
with everything
within moments.
I mean, just like talk about blue. We're already conditioned blue.
Right. Yeah.
I think little boys, masculine. I mean, you know, there are things that I don't even realize that I've already.
Well,
you know,
I'm going to give you some bad news.
Impossible.
It gets more and more subtle than that.
That's what I'm saying.
Good.
Things I don't even. This is general. Blue. What do you think? What does everybody think? You know, blue and pink.
Yeah.
We all from this culture.
Now, when I just look at you right now,
mm-hmm.
I'm doing it too.
Mm-hmm.
Store. I'm just, my mental processes are all on autopilot.
Do you see me, the person, or do you see my true self?
I can't find your true self.
Huh?
I can't find your true self. It's relative. What's the true self?
Well,
there's someone there. What's your name?
Melissa.
Okay, there's a Melissa. There's something there, right?
Yeah. But that's
I'll
not
try.
Really me. That's my parents gave me.
Yeah.
I've been conditioned to respond like you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you said Melissa, I'm like, what? Because I think that's me. Do you know what
there's
I mean?
There's someone there.
Right, exactly. I don't live life. I am life. Mm-hmm. Just like everybody else,
So the trick is to live more and more in what is reality.
Right, which is the present. Really, the true reality is like the very present moment. Like there is no more past. I mean, there's no past. That doesn't exist. And there's really no future, because once the future gets here, it's actually present.
Hmm.
And then talk about waiting,
about that, waiting. I'm not going to go that direction right at the moment, just because I could say a lot, but I want to, behind you.
I want to comment that, this is how I see things. Traffic is not going to get better or worse because how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
If you feel anxious, traffic is going to stay whatever traffic is. So you have the power to decide how you want to feel when there's traffic.
Okay, so I'm trying to push you further. That's good. That's good. What I'm trying to take you further is, what is the traffic? What is the traffic at all? How does the traffic exist?
Well, it's...
Don't answer. You don't have to answer. But that's where we want to go. Where does the traffic exist that we're reacting to? And who is the reactor?
Yeah,
this
are.
Is the spiritual path.
Yeah.
So it's not like there's an answer.
Yeah.
It goes deeper, 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 perceptually. Deeper, deeper, deeper. Okay? But I want to expand your question. You know, when you start the inquiry, sure. Because I hear that a lot. That people think that Buddhist practice is only in how we react. It's not. That's kind of the beginning level. Well, I can't say it's the beginning level. But, you know, it goes deeper than that. I mean, our reaction is always it. But how we change our reactions is according to perception. And our perceptions, we need to deepen, deepen, deepen. They can get extremely deep. Okay? Now, what you were describing is a deep perception for someone who has no clue, right? Like I can change, the traffic is only how I feel about it. A lot of people don't even have that idea, do they? They think it's really there. They work on the roads, they work on the signs, they work on the, you know, they spend their whole life working with traffic because they think it's really there. And not just what they feel about it. And you were talking about, well, it's more my attitude about it, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to push you even further because it is your attitude, but it's even more. How does traffic even exist? How do you exist? Okay? We'll leave it there. Okay? I'm going to go on. Can I go on a little bit? Is it okay? I should let you ask because it's not fair.
You're right there. It's fair.
It's fair? Go. She's... Okay. So the reason we see traffic that way and the reason we react, that one level of training of the mind gets us to do what you were describing, to begin to realize that I can control my reaction to the traffic. Okay? That is mind training. Okay? And then what we can do is, in this level of mind training that we're talking about in Buddhist practice, is we go into curiosity. It's a curious mind, true curiosity, in the sense of the scientific inquiry. You know, true science, right? True science, and I don't know how many true scientists there are anymore, were just open inquirers. With some discipline, they had a formula. Okay, now I don't know. It's not like that so much. They're still. I think quantum physicists are the most open-minded. I think, if I were to make a judgment, that's not fair to say. But to be a quantum physicist, I think you have to be quite open-minded. Correct? Yeah. So now we have to be like quantum physicists. That's what meditation, mind training. Should be, and I said should. Some people tell me you shouldn't say should. Have you heard that before?
Yeah.
Do you think you shouldn't say should? I shouldn't say should?
That would be my vote.
Maybe your vote. Yeah. I understand that. It's just hard not to say it. You know, I couldn't say you shouldn't kill. I can't say that. But I mean, people who say you shouldn't say should, can't even say shouldn't kill? Can't say that? It's okay. Okay. Sorry, it's a tangent. Sorry. We'll have the discussion sometime. Because I do run into that. People, there's some philosophy about shouldn't say should. I think I understand it, but maybe I'm just being stubborn. Okay, curiosity and openness. Your meditation, your mind training has to include always curiosity and openness. Okay? Because you're going to become familiar. So about mind training and meditation, it is about control. It's about making the mind serviceable. It means you can do what you want with your mind. When we become very adept meditators, mind trainers, we have control over the mind. Okay, that's the point. There's a system of mind training in Buddhism, particularly Tibetan Buddhism, called Tantra, Vajrayana. And in Vajrayana practice, it includes visualizing deities and things like that. And for purpose of mind training. And once Lama Yeshe was asked, this, what you're asking us to do is just fantasy. You know, you're just asking us to engage in fantasy. How is that helpful? And his reply was, you're already hallucinating. We're giving you a better one. And actually, when you do practice in the Vajrayana practice, you have that awareness that it's mental creation. You don't have the awareness, oh, these are really self-existent from their own side, deities, gods. You don't. If you have that, you can't practice Vajrayana. So you know that the mind's creating reality. That's what we're talking about. All the discussion about the traffic and the violence, let's back it up and say, do you believe your mind creates your reality or not? That's all. And if you're a Nangpa, which means Buddhist, which means inner being, you accept that. You may not know how it happens. You may not know to what extent. But you are open and curious about finding out. My mind creates my reality. Wow. How does it do that? Give me some ideas. Let's check it out. Okay, it doesn't mean you accept it. It doesn't mean we accept it. You can't just accept it. But I think it's fascinating to be sitting here right now and even having the question, my mind is creating this reality. Isn't that fantastic? Now, some people get scared. That's okay. That's understandable. And then you just get so curious. Well, what is it then? Okay? What is the violence? What is the traffic? My mind creates reality. I took this class with this guy and he started talking about that. What does that mean? So I'm just encouraging people to be courageous, open, and curious. That's what meditation is, in my point of view. I think in the Buddhist point of view. You can never lose that curiosity and openness no matter what Buddhist practice you're doing. Otherwise it becomes rigid. And, well, self-existence is one of those words we use. I haven't explained it. So, making the mind serviceable. All of a sudden the more you get control of the mind, the more you can create your reality differently. How about that? You don't like your reality? Make a new one. It's all just created anyway. Okay, there are some rules, yes.
And this goes to what I was going to say earlier.
Sure.
What you said before, I call it a disidentification, like tool or process.
Mm-hmm.
I have anger. I am not my anger.
Mm-hmm.
It's like to acknowledge the awareness.
Yes.
From all of the sense organs and all of that. And then it's almost like opening a little window into this other place.
Yes, exactly.
I am not that.
Right.
I was trained in this, to do this with a number of people, and we used to do it as a group.
Mm-hmm.
It was had amazing results.
Yeah.
So I learned that, you know, you can. It's almost like that movement from the meditation cushion into life.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one of those tools to take along.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
All day long, I'm going to experience this and. This is not who I really am or what I really am.
Yeah, we develop those. That's right. That's right.
So I just wanted to reiterate
that.
That's
yeah,
a really good tool
yeah,
to
it is.
Use.
Thank you.
Should everyone use it? I don't know.
Of course they should. I want to get, so I want to make sure, we have some time, but I want to make sure I get to one part of this presentation. Interventions. So in Buddhist psychology, we have a couple of different levels of intervening. So we're on the same page. We're talking about the inner world now, okay, Nangpa. And just like some people have said here, you know, it's the irritation with the traffic, not the traffic. So we're kind of, I think we all accept that there's an inner approach, that the problem is something internal, mental. That's why we say Buddhist psychology. So these things that are blocks are what, in the common, in the traditional language, are referred to as afflictions, or we can say mental disorders. Okay, disorders are sometimes bigger in the true sense of the use mental disorders, but afflictions like anger and attachment and jealousy and envy and insecurity and fear and. What else? Things like that. They obscure the mind. Remember that clarity, which is our goal, that clear state of mind? Well, these obscure it. So that's why we try to get rid of those, so the natural quality of the mind can just arise. And that natural quality of the mind, as Lam Yeshe said yesterday in the quote, our basic pure human nature is much better place to live than where we're living now. And this is considered, from the psychological point of view, from the Buddhist point of view, confusion. We live in confusion. And that confusion is really created by ignorance, not seeing things correctly. Because I don't see things correctly, I'm hypnotized in thinking that Donna's blue blouse is really there. And then I either like it or I don't like it. It happens every instant. It gives me a good sensation or a bad sensation. That happens every instant. And people go, well, so what? Well, let's go backwards again. It's coming from ignorance. It's not really how it is. Wouldn't you rather function in how things are? I would. Okay. So when these things are coming, the irritation with the traffic as an affliction, you're irritated. You can block it. Just block. I'm not going to go there. Okay? That's one level of intervening in a Buddhist sense. Clear? It's like irritated with someone at work. And you usually come and you talk to your friends about it. And then the blocking one is, you know, that's just not right. I know it's my irritation. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm just not going to, you know. Now, does that get rid of the problem? It actually doesn't. But it is an intervention that's valid. Okay? Or you protect yourself. Okay? That's also part of blocking the afflictions. I use the metaphor often of alcoholics. You want to stop drinking. Don't go to bars. Does it get rid of the alcoholism? It actually doesn't. Because it's a mental state, right? But it's helpful. It's functional. It's better. So if you find that you get taken over by certain afflictions more than others, just find a way to block them. Block from engaging in them is a better way to put it. Okay. Now, a more permanent solution is actually to face the emotions and analyze them. Okay, well, that's number three. But face the emotions. So this is where you just watch them arise, abide, and fall away. You don't cling. You know what happens? That you know, the irritation might come up about the traffic, but what makes it worse is when you engage with it, right? What are these stupid people coming on a Sunday for? Why aren't they in church? Right? That's engaging with it. Okay? As opposed to watching, okay, the irritation arises. You see you want to engage with it, and you just don't. It abides for a moment, and you watch it fade away. Maybe it abides for 10 minutes, but you're still watching it all that time, and then fade away. You're not engaging with it. Okay? That's number two. Third one is, it arises, you confront it, you start to analyze it. Like, where is it coming from? What's my sense of self that's involved? Where am I being tricked into thinking this is real? And then you actually feel like, I actually want this problem to come up because it's allowing me to develop my wisdom and understanding and maybe my compassion. It will do that. So that's the third one. Okay? I just like the picture. So it is a practice in more advanced practices where problems are engaged with and invited as friends because they are the things enlightened, bring out the qualities that we need of patience, tolerance, joy, compassion, empathy. You can't develop compassion without a problem, actually. You can't develop compassion unless you have an object to be compassionate towards. It's just intellectual then. That develops compassion in action with engaging with other human beings, or beings, I should say. Okay? Okay, so this is what I wanted to get to. This is in the book. Maybe it's useful. Maybe for some people here this is not useful because you have your way of dealing with it. But I'll share it with you anyway. And we'll just keep using either. Think of an issue that you struggle with. You know, for me it is, sometimes it is traffic. I do get upset in traffic, so. Or maybe the political situation. You know, you find yourself charged. You know, it's irritating. You know, you get upset. It could be anything. Okay? So just something that's really tangible, or maybe it's someone at work, or maybe it's a child or a partner. Okay? Something they do that keeps coming up. So these are the four steps that are outlined in the book. Okay, this alone might even change everything. When you just engage, if you just remember the first step, which is there's always a choice. So when you hit the traffic and you start getting irritated and kind of pissed off, what's missing there, if you're not careful, is that you have a choice whether to go there or not. In other words, this precious human life. If you go into that irritation, that's not very, very, it's not really actualizing the beauty of this life, is it? You're kind of being pulled down into some lower existence. You know what I mean? You know, you think about, you know, who are you when you're irritated with traffic, you know? What level of consciousness is that? What level of humanness is that? You know, sometimes it's like you're not even a human. You become like, I don't know. I'm sure there's some animal that could be parallel to the agitated person in traffic. Maybe you become like a predator or something like a... Anyone got an idea? Anything come to mind? The Hulk. I guess the best. Yeah, okay. New Hulk. I was thinking of a not for traffic. Thinking about chipmunks. You know how vigilant they are. Like they always. That chipmunk created that chipmunk consciousness from something. Acting a certain way that now it's acting as a chipmunk. Maybe some sign of vigilance. Maybe, I don't want to say. I think maybe work on an assembly line or something. Not worrying about your boss, you know. Something like that. You have vigilance. It's fantasy, but some came from somewhere. So if the first thing to think is that who you really want to be? You know? Who do you want to be when the problem comes up? Overwhelm at work. You think you don't have a choice? You do. Stuck in traffic. You think you don't have a choice? You do. Your partner yelling at you. You don't think you have a choice? You do. Criticizing you. You do always have a choice. The problem for us is we're habitual, we're in reactivity. So, you know, they talk a lot about if you create a gap, just a moment, and remember that you have a choice. Is that who you really want to be? Who do you want to be? All of us would say, actually, I don't want to be that person. I want to change that. That's the step, okay? Remembering that. Okay? Always can do one over the other. Same thing is about set up your laboratory. So it's good to just at least catch yourself that you have a choice. Okay? But then you can do more. This is what makes it transformative. In setting up your laboratory, this is borrowed from a friend of mine from the Potential Project. Only I elaborated a little bit. He calls the ABCD method. People familiar with this? Anyone? It's very helpful. Because it's easy to remember ABCD. I added the E all by myself. Because ABCD is about mindfulness. And I like to take people beyond mindfulness. It's one of my, it's another soapbox of mine. So the A stands for anatomy. So you can do this in your car too, okay, or wherever you are. The point is, remember you have a choice. Okay, I don't want to be that person. I have a choice. So then you check in with your body, okay? And if you can, just notice the tension in the body and you let it go. Because we're never aware of our body in the conflict. Rarely, right? We really don't check in with our body and you can see you're holding your teeth tight or sitting in a sort of a stiff way. And the other part about anatomy is if you can actually then sit in a sort of meditative posture or environment. Now, it doesn't mean you have to be sitting like this. You sit in a chair or you can lie down on your bed as long as you don't go to sleep. Somewhere where your back is straight, you're kind of alert, and you can leave the body alone. Anyway, if you're in your car, then you kind of check in whether you're like this. Just relax, and be at ease. If you're in your office, you can do this. Someone just came in and it was not a very good interaction. They've left. And you go, and you start getting pissed off or whatever or sad. And you go, oh, I have a choice. And sad, by the way, I always talk about anger. Sadness is also a destructive emotion. I'm talking about compassion. I'm talking about sadness, self-indulgent sadness, often self-pity. Okay? We all have it, by the way, and it's going to happen. But just start seeing that it's not a very constructive mind, actually. It's not a really... So choice, I don't have to be knee-jerk reaction. That guy always comes in my office or my manager or whatever, is so condescending, he leaves, and it's like, yeah. But then you catch it. I have a choice. It's not who I want to be in life. Life is short. I want to be something more exalted. Then B is set up your laboratory. So then you just, don't look at your computer screen for a moment or whatever you're doing, just relax, find the tension, sit, maybe close your eyes, whatever. And then, so that's and the anatomy. The B, oh, don't worry about this. This is longer stuff. Relax neck, shoulders, hands resting on the knees. Eyes shutter partly open. Don't worry about that. That's all the meditation posture. But you guys know this. The B then now, so you're in a, and so Donna's had this, you don't work in an office like that anymore, do you? Mm. Who works in that kind of office? Okay. So then what you do, so then next thing, so you see how you've changed the whole dynamic. Because when we're just in reaction, we start tensing up. We don't really have a choice. We start yelling at that person in our head. But now you've changed it all around. You've got a choice. Your body's, okay, you feel your tension. And then you then just get the focus onto the breath. And if you're very agitated, you can focus on the breath in the abdomen. And you don't control the breath, right? You just let it do what it's doing. In fact, if you're agitated, it might be going kind of fast and shallow. In this exercise, you don't manipulate either way. You just accept where it's at. I like them at the tip of the nose, but if you're really, really agitated, you can use the abdomen going in and out. Okay, so that's the breath. Think about the breath as it's neutral, right? And it's your anchor. So the breath becomes your anchor. Then you just see neutral. The breath, I often tell people, it's like looking at traffic from a high up in a building. If it's congested, you can't do anything about it. If it's light, you can't do anything about it. People are honking and stuff, you can't do it. That's like the breath. You're just watching the breath no matter what it's like. Okay? And then C is you counting. Yeah, and the counting in this exercise is when you exhale, you do the count. So inhale, one. Inhale, out, two. Inhale, out, three. So the breath is your anchor. And now the counting is really, for all of us, but especially for beginners, or especially if you're distracted. Then when you get to 10, then it's really fun, because then you do the same thing, external, exhale, 9, 8, so you go backwards. And ideally you do it 3 times. It's 30, whatever, 30, I guess it's 60. It takes about 6 minutes, 7 minutes. If you get, this is the idea. Now if you're in an office and you've just got a few minutes, you just do it 1 round or 5 or whatever, okay? And the only thing with the counting is if you completely lose count because you've gone way out, you have to start over. It's a punishment. But not if you just get like a little vague, because we are that way. And then particularly when you know about D. What's D? Any guesses? Distractions. Distraction is part of this practice. Okay? So that's what I meant about your counting, but they're always, at our level, there's some level of distraction. Because whether it's and the distractions come through the 5 senses. Usually when we're meditating or doing this, you might have closed your eyes, so it's going to be probably in your hearing or your thoughts. And in this case, all the practice, you're being successful, is when you're doing your counting and you catch a distraction. That's the practice. Not to not have distractions, but to recognize them. And one of the distractions, in this particular case, one of the distractions will be you're doing this thing and all of a sudden you realize you're yelling at your boss or the guy who's irritating you. Okay? Because that's the way the mind works. It gets distracted very quickly back to that object that you're really attached to. Negative attached or positively attached. Negative attachment is anger. Positive attachment is pleasure. Okay? And you just say, oh, wow, I went to arguing with my coworker, or that irritator. Oh, I went thinking about the traffic. Okay? And you bring it back. So you're successful when you do that. You don't have to start over counting. Okay, so I just like to share that with you. And again, this group, you know, I understand most people have a practice and stuff, but maybe this is helpful. Maybe helpful to explain to other people, like your kids who don't care about these ideas, or your parents or whoever, you know, brothers and sisters. Okay, so that's all. That is E now, the best one, inquiry. Okay, now inquiry is why we come to the center and take classes. We learn hundreds and hundreds of different methods and formulas for inquiry, right? That's what it's meant. It means analyze. We have permission to analyze. Most traditions, like meditation, they frown upon analyzing. But we incorporate it into meditation. Sometimes I think a good word is critical thinking. So the way we engage in critical thinking or analyzing is through formulas. So I think I can't cover formulas in this class, but I encourage you to then find out about what these different kinds of inquiry are. A couple that I'll just mention, traditional ones. I don't think I do this in the book. I don't think I cover inquiry. I think I added this later. So inquiry would be things like, let's just do it for a second. I'll give you an inquiry. This is one, just get comfortable if you can. Okay, so you're going to have to come up with your own personal problem. Something that you maybe struggle with or you very clearly get irritated by or fearful of, or it makes you depressed or confused. Okay, and then you generate, wow, I have a choice. I can become a superhuman being, not just a regular reactive person. I have a choice. I don't have to be whipsawed around by that problem. So that's the first one, choice. I can do something like that. It gives you power. Set up your laboratory is A. Is a second step. Set up your laboratory, which is about the ABCDE method. So that's where we're at right now. So A, just check your body. It's comfortable. You're not holding tension anywhere. If you are, just let it go. And then B is the breath. So identify and find your anchor at the tip of the nose, the sensation of the air going in and out. C is counting. So why don't we do a round of 1 through 10 and 10 through 1. And while you're counting, if there's distractions, just you acknowledge it. And just say, oh, a distraction. And come back to the breath. So the E and the inquiry for this particular practice we're doing right now. So you have your problem still. So bring it back up. It might have actually disappeared. So bring it back up into your, awareness. The E that you're going to apply here, the inquiry, is you're just going to inquire whether it is impermanent, the problem is impermanent or permanent. Definition of impermanence is it changes moment to moment. And of course the definition of permanence is not changing moment to moment. Just look at the problem and and inquire as to which one of those it is, and then to see its nature in whichever one it is. Still paying attention to the D, distractions. Go back to the inquiry. Okay, so we'll just stop there. We could have kept going, I guess, huh? Yeah. So that's the four steps. Oh, that's not the four steps. So that's only step two? But that's good enough. The other two we don't need. The other one is, what was I thinking? Which we just did. You could do that as your inquiry. In other words, what that is what emotion is arising. Because we're not very in touch with our emotions. I mean, people here might be. But in general, it's really funny with people. They, you know, what emotion did you... No, I'm just... This guy, I'm just angry with this guy. He knows he shouldn't cut me off like that. Right? That's how most the world goes through. They're not... No, but what emotion were you feeling? Well, I don't know. Anyone would feel angry. Now people say... Okay, anyone would be irritated with people cut you off. Okay, so that's the third one. But really, we covered so much in one and two. I found that. Okay, so what was I thinking? So being clearer about what is going on inside of us. What was I thinking? And then you take action. Now, because I added the E, these other last two steps seem sort of redundant. But if you're gonna help other people, or if you do it yourself, you can leave off the E and put the E in here and to take action. But there's, like I said, you know, there's 84,000 different actions we can take within the Buddhist interventions. Okay? E inquiry is one of the main interventions, but then there's many different kinds of inquiry. We just used impermanence, for example. But there's really a whole plethora of, you know, we use interdependence, we use absence of self-existence, okay? Those are the main ones, actually, the inquiries. But there's many. Perfect human rebirth, death and death. We have inquiry around death. So, for example, when you're in your meditation and you saw your irritation, whatever the issue was, you could do an inquiry around death. An inquiry around death is okay, I'm sitting here upset at my coworker, and then the inquiry around death is, okay, in light of that, of what I'm experiencing, is death going to happen or not? It's an inquiry. It's not like, of course it's going to happen. No, but then it's like, okay, so what are you holding instead? Are you aware of that? No, actually, wasn't thinking that. So then all of a sudden you become aware, yes, definitely this guy, me, is going to disappear from this office. Then the second part, the time of death, is an indefinite, right? Wow, I could die this afternoon before I leave, right? Is that right? Let me inquire about that. Yes. Okay. And that means before you can even... that. What does that do to this argument you're having with this irritating person? And third in that inquiry, and this is not a class about it, is to... that, definitely going to die, don't know when, what's going to help then? Only thing that helps is mental development. mental clarity, mental strength. That's all that helps. Spirituality, whatever you want to call it. Okay? Right. By the way, in this inquiry, as we just know from our deeper Buddhist practice, if you're doing your inquiry and you get an insight, I didn't say this. I've never said this normally in these classes. But the real purpose of the inquiry is to generate an insight. All of a sudden, you're just blown away by death is definite. Wow! Even though you know it isn't beyond intellect, there is the level where it's insight, and you actually see the definiteness of death. Okay, at that point, you stop inquiring and you zero in on that feeling or that insight. Okay. That's a real, I mean, just for this class, that's what you want to do. You want to take it to that level. Okay, take action, and we won't talk about those. A few minutes more. Is it okay? You'd say okay anyway, right? It's not a very fair question. How are you doing? Exhausted? No? Jeez. I'm not either. Okay. So we know what a living being is now. It's a body and it's a mind, right? Okay. We did this. We didn't do this. It's all about me. At the center of... Okay, so let's go real quickly. I mean, so we have a body, we have a mind, right? But the thing we didn't talk about is there's this kind of... there's a central thing that everything's moving around. So these are the secondary mental factors, we call them. So in our mind, we have this primary mind, this clarity, clear mind. But that's not always, you know, there's also stuff happening. So we have things like always present, is things like, well, we're always feeling and contact, we're always in contact and perceiving. And then, what's the second one say? Ascertaining, don't worry, there's five others that come up when our mind gets more subdued, then we're ascertaining, which are like used in meditation. Okay. There's some argument about whether those are active all the time or just when we're meditating. I don't know. Then wholesome. So not everything's bad. According to this, this is just a model, by the way. Don't think of it as self-existent, you know, true. But in this model, which is taught to the monks and, you know, amongst, you know, Tibetan Buddhists, or just the Buddhists, not Tibetan, but Buddhists, we learned that there's 11 wholesome minds. So it's not all bad. Wholesome mind, like conscientiousness, self-awareness, non-violence or non-hatred, non-greed, affection, something like that. And there's not only 11. Just in this, they just outline 11 in this old text. We maybe have to, we can't really change it, but maybe we have to do a new one. And say, yes, yeah, because one of the really interesting, I'll show you, then there's variable. There's four variable ones, like sleep. Sleep is a mental factor. That's all it is. Pretty strong one. Why is this variable? Those four can be good or bad. So sleep can be okay, or it can be really bad. Why? If you really went into sleeping, you just want to, like, I love my sleep, I just want to sleep all day, that then the mental factor of sleep becomes negative. The other one is, I want to sleep. I hope I feel good in the morning so I can continue my work, my job, helping people, whatever. That would be a wholesome. So that's up to you. Okay, there's four variables. Now, the secondary afflictions, there's like 20. That's like, envy, spite, laziness, things like that. They're secondary because they're stimulated by the one at 10 o'clock, main affliction. So those are six of those. And the 21, 20 down below are just very refinements of the six main afflictions. Six main afflictions are things like greed, anger, ignorance, pride, wrong view, something else. Jealousy? Jealousy, I don't think it's a secondary. Isn't it? No, secondary. I could get it if I had. Anyway, those are five of the six. How about that? But the point here is these are all going on, right? Whether they're wholesome or negative, afflictions, whatever. But what we're not talking about is in all of that is this sense of I. I'm angry. I'm happy. I'm helping you. Okay? I'm being self-aware. I'm sleeping. Any one of these mental factors, that are any mental experience, even I'm meditating so that maybe the afflictions aren't even arising at that moment, there's still I. Okay? There's still a sense of self. And that sense of self actually is directly connected with all the problems and all the good things. In other words, you can't develop a spiritual practice in the beginning without a sense of self, right? I need to meditate. I need to be a better person. I need to clarify my mind. I need to purify. I need to be of benefit to others. I need, right? So it's not that all eyes are created equal. They're not. The eye that wants to hunt and kill animals is not of the same quality as the eye that wants to be of benefit to others. Okay? So this eye that we think of as me, myself, when I call out your name, that person that you feel. Okay? Okay, you ready? So that's the one that's sort of the ringmaster. And all the mental disorders are related with that. So when we talk about modern day disorders, like, you know, bipolar or attention deficit disorder, depression, anxiety, there's an I involved in all those, isn't there? So in Buddhist psychology, and I'm going to probably leave you kind of with this. In Buddhist psychology, the focus in the early stages is on all those afflictions, like anger and all those things. But then you work with those. Like instead of, just like someone said about the traffic. So one way of working with the irritation of the traffic is start thinking about, well, all the poor people who are stuck in it, just like me. So that's working against the affliction. What that does is that activates a wholesome mind. So the wholesome minds generally are not activated because the afflictive minds are more active. And we're recruited, we're trained in the afflictive minds, unfortunately. Much more. Not everybody. You know, you meet people, like some people, they just automatically like that person. You know? Isn't she great? Oh yeah, I love her. You know? Well, you'll find if that kind of person, they have more of the wholesome mind is more active than, say, other people. You know, your favorite uncle. You know, that lady down the street that's always helping people. It comes from because they're what we call those virtue wholesome minds are activated for her or him. And actually, it's really interesting. If you do an investigation, you'll probably find she's happier. That's what's funny about the wholesome minds are happier minds than the afflicted minds. Okay, well, we kind of know that, but as you really research people, you go, he's a happier person. No, he's not a happier person. He's really a sad person, an unhappy person. It's probably because one of the secondary afflictions or root afflictions is more active in their world. Like greed or anger. Okay? This is a small thing, but it's helpful. But in all of those, there's a sense of I. So we could focus on when I'm irritated with the traffic or with the guy mowing the lawn at 5 in the morning, it is possible, it's helpful to say, oh, that's my irritation, that's my anger, that's my attachment, whatever. That's useful because that's the inquiry part, trying to understand our psychology. And then you could say, oh, well, you know, Joe's mowing the lawn at 5 a.m. because he has to go out. And he can't do it anytime. He's trying to keep his wife happy, right? Because she really wants him to do the lawn before he leaves. So that reduces one's affliction. Now, does it get rid of it? No. And this is the big news. So the only thing that permanently gets rid of those mental afflictions or disorders is there's two approaches you can permanently get rid of. Only one way to get permanently rid of it, and that's why I've harped on it so much for these 3 or 4 days, is the understanding of reality. It's the only thing that gets rid of it permanently. That, in the Buddhist terminology, is understanding emptiness. Emptiness, but it's not emptiness. It's emptiness of existing inherently. Empty of existing independently. Oh, that sounds pretty philosophical. Well, wait, it's not. When you're irritated by the lawnmower at 5 a.m, it's fundamentally, okay, you could say, oh, it's Joe, you know, trying to keep his wife happy. That helps you have a little empathy, right? That reduces your affliction. And so, but the only thing that would get rid of it is because you see, or in this case, hear the noise of the lawnmower, and you see it as existing from its own side, which it doesn't. Another way of saying it, I'll just repeat it. The reason the lawnmower sound is irritating is because you see it existing inherently. Another way of saying it, these are all synonyms. Technically, slightly different, but it's okay for our. The only reason you're irritated by Joe's lawnmower, the sound, is because you see it existing independently. And that's not the way it exists. It doesn't exist that way. It doesn't exist independently. And that's why we have that all problems, all unhappiness, all ignorance, all of what our existence is because we see things that way. So you can then, as we get more trained, you can actually shift the perception. I see that the reason I'm irritated with the lawnmower sound is I see it independently. I've learned that. I know it. I can't really, don't know really quite what that means, or I can't practice that, but I hear that that's what the main problem is. And then you just, over time, begin to see that it doesn't exist independently. Over time, long time. The other approach, so that's the only thing that will get rid of the problem for good. Okay, now, the other strategy is you hear the sound of Joe's lawnmower, and you see, instead of seeing the sound of the lawnmower, the problem, as you see hearing the sound independently, the problem is I hear that sound and think it exists independently. So independently means it exists over there by itself, right? That's what this means. So the other way you can do it is the hearer, the subject, okay, karuna. I see karuna, I experience karuna existing independently. So you can either do the object or the subject. Okay? You eventually have to do the subject anyway. But we believe I, the hearer, okay, now we talked about that. If I call out your name, that I, when you react. If I say, Karen, I'm assuming there's only one Karen. Karen, you know, she said, oh, he's calling me, right? I say, Donna. I say, David. If I say your name, right, don't you get a feeling of me. That I, so you should do that. So that is the guy or gal who's listening to lawnmower and is being irritated, right? And just to make a point, you say, I hate that noise. Why is he doing that? I hate that. You got to get that strong. That is the subject. That is the other way to go on solving the problem. That I we perceive as existing independently, or truly, or inherently, whatever word you want to use, and it doesn't exist that way. When we focus on that, the problem goes away. Okay, and that, what we're talking about, is a process. Please understand, it goes, even if you have experience of it, your experience will go deeper, 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 and goes, you know, we can't subtle, subtle, deeper into what happens. Eventually, all your day and all your night, you're spending your time in reality. Unreality is, I'm sitting here and you're sitting there. That's unreality. And that's where we spend our, not just our life, but lives. And then we start making a switch. And who knows how long that switch takes to fully not do that anymore. It might take 3 years. Most likely it takes 3 lifetimes. But it has a finite end to it. The other one has no end. The way of seeing it incorrectly has no end. And the danger is, if we don't do something about it, the danger is that the incorrect of seeing, you know, we think, oh, okay, big deal, I got a good life. Got a good partner, good kids. You know, live in Santa Cruz. The problem is, and this is, I don't mean to sound religious, the problem is you have no idea what you're going to have next. First of all, you don't know how long that's going to last. Might only last a few months more. You know, or some, maybe you get, and not again, not to be negative or religious, you know, but it happens, right? Santa Cruz, the 1989 earthquake was 1 mile from my house, the epicenter. Just so happened we had moved into a new house and had all the earthquake stuff. We weren't one of the 105 people sitting on that bridge that got smashed. Might be next time. Who knows? That's why we got to do this. You don't know. I don't know. Not only that, so this life is going to end. It could end so. I mean, right? I mean, it's just reality. It might end tomorrow. And you know what? When it ends, it'll be tomorrow. 80 years from now, or not 80 years. If it's 20, 30 years from now, when we die, it'll be today. Just like we're here today. It's going to feel like that. We're going to have the same misconceptions. I'm going to live forever. Okay? So, do you know what's going to happen after that? Are you sure it's not going to be as good as this? No, are you sure it's not going to be better than this? What am I saying? Are you sure it's going to be like this? We don't know, do we? If you extend the logic around the consciousness, and the consciousness is a stream of impermanent movement, moment to moment, it ain't going to stop when this body stops. If you look logically, scientifically, psychologically, does electricity disappear from this building just when we tear the building down? Does electricity disappear from this building? Does electricity disappear when we destroy the building? Science, my science friend. It doesn't, does it? Same with consciousness, just like that. The difference between electricity and this, and the consciousness is electricity doesn't need to find a new building to go into. But the consciousness does. It has to find a body. And typically they say within 49 days. I think that's right. I think typically it's within a few hours of death. Probably. Doesn't matter, but within 49 days. That's why, okay, we better, you know, I'm not trying to scare people, it's just reality. I'm scared a little bit about that. I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure that I have that golden ticket. Okay, so I went on that avenue with you. So that's the solution. So, okay, not to lose that. So as you develop, now, a lot of us can't just start there when I feel, you know I have these mental disorders or these afflictions, like I have anger, I have misconception, you know, I have these things, I have attachment to baseball, you know, golf, my family, you know. But as it comes up, and I now know to rid myself of those, then ultimately, I mean permanently, is I either need to focus on how I'm seeing things incorrectly in terms of the object, or how I'm seeing things incorrectly in terms of the subject. Okay? And then, of course, this Kadampa Center, they go into quite a bit of more detail about that, those topics, right? I mean, Geshe-la teaches and stuff. So that's why, you know, those philosophy classes, sometimes we don't really get it, and we just kind of get bored by it or something, or I don't know. But it's psychology. It's so that we do better. Okay, so there's 2 minutes, and I got about 20. I see how more slides.
You could leave tomorrow.
30, 40. I only have 114 more slides. Maybe they're duplicates, I don't know. Okay, so any last questions? Because it is 4 o'clock, or 2 minutes to 4. Any suggestions? Yes.
So, in your opinion, your belief, you don't think there's anything beyond that I state, I present?
Say it again.
Hello?
Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
So in your belief or your opinion, you don't think there's anything beyond that I, that me, I state present? You think that's where it...
I would say, do I believe anything beyond that? No, I do believe there's something beyond that. I think that definitely there's something beyond that. I think that belief in the I think I'm understanding, if I understand your question, the misconception of the I, and I think what you're asking is, do I think there's anything beyond the correct perception? Is that what you're saying? Mm-hmm. Go ahead and ask again. Elaborate a little more.
Okay, I understand the, you know, the... You're calling it the me, I, you know, the I, mm-hmm. you know, as a person, my name is Melissa, I'm a female,
right.
I'm an American, I speak English, all of that.
Yeah.
Because you're just like kind of focusing
right.
on everything being affected by yeah. that position.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm asking is, you know, your belief or opinion that it doesn't go beyond that. You know, state of awareness.
Oh, no, it goes way beyond that.
Right, so, yeah. I mean, to, like, be aware of that, you know,
that's just the beginning. That's
right,
the beginning.
But, I mean, so, understanding that, you can understand, you can start to understand all these, you know, little things that, you know, you're talking about, because, you know, it's a connect, you know, everything is connected.
What I was, yes, and when we can't see the perception of everything, for example, the perception of everything being interconnected, right? The perception of everything being interconnected or interdependent. The connection with everything is empty of existing the way it appears. With all of that, as we develop that, it allows for something else to take its place. In other words, if I said, when you see that the self or the I or the me doesn't exist that way, it's like
at all.
That would be saying that then there's nothing that exists at all in terms of a person. In terms of, you know, like you were saying,
right.
Melissa, okay? But I'm not saying that. What exists in of Melissa is not manifest. And in Kruin, too, it's not manifest because this other thing is taking the place. It's taking up all the space. So what takes its place, and that's good, I mean, that's important, is we talk about this Buddha nature, for example. Buddha nature. Much nicer idea than just talking about what all the problems and the wrong conception. But we talk about the wrong conception. This is very, very interesting. What you're asking, when I perceive, so I misperceive me, right? I see it wrongly. That's what we're talking. And then your question was, well, just seeing it, you know, is that all it is? Is seeing it correctly? And so seeing it correctly, what automatically happens is a activation of of what we refer to as, say, the Buddha nature or the awakened mind. Okay, that awakened mind can't happen when we're seeing things incorrectly. So there's a lot more to us than just that. Okay? And then, because else, why would we do it? What fun is that? You know, I mean, great, so I become nothing. It's not that. That's an extreme. That's my fault. So that's that extreme of nihilism. We don't become nothing. Who would want to do that? It's a very good question. It's a very important question what you brought.
But if my name is Melissa, really truly, I'm not a male or a female, and these are all the me I.
Yeah.
I believe, okay, I'm a female, and just believing the female, I'm playing, I'm interacting with all the, you know, conceptions of being a female.
It's also.
And it's about everything that I think about me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not who I truly am. I'm not Melissa living a life or my life. I am life itself. Just like everybody else is. I mean, you know, everybody's thinking, oh, I'm a boy, I'm a girl, I'm
yeah.
that, and all that. That's the things that aren't, you know, true.
Well, and also they're not true. So what I'm trying to say is, because that would be nihilism, to say, you're not a woman.
What is the thing of, what is it, the law of polarity?
Yeah, so I don't know, but let me just answer the question. So I'm not saying you're not a woman. I'm not saying you're not a human being. I'm not saying that you're not all those other things you said. What I am saying is you're not those absolutely, ultimately. Those are relative parts
right,
of Melissa.
There's something about us that is
ultimate.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Forever present.
Yes. You have a mind, don't you? Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's like that's the activity. It's like I can still be here. I can. You know, meditation. You shut everything down because I can take away all distractions and this, that, and the other. That's still something.
There's still some. Yeah. Do you want to know what's still there?
Life.
Your mind. I'm just talking about the parts of the mind that are problematic. The parts of the mind that are the most extraordinary thing, more extraordinary than God. Okay? But we can't access that because we're all distracted and, well, not just distracted, we're all overwhelmed by these wrong beliefs. Let's leave it at that. Okay? So not nihilism. It's not that there's no Melissa. Once you get rid of this, I'll cease to exist. That's not true. That's not true, and it's my mistake if I gave that impression. You broke it.
Okay, there it goes. This is an easy one.
That last time. It wasn't that easy.
I'm asking your opinion.
Yeah.
Because you've talked about death quite a bit, and I've been through people dying quite a bit, and going through hospice, which seems nice. But it occurs to me, if people going through hospice take a lot of drugs and stuff, and like for the last 6 or 7 days, you know, they're just like drugged out, it seems like it would affect how their mind transfers.
Mm.
Is there an opinion on that?
Yeah, there's opinion. I'm not sure. I guess there's, well, I'll tell you my opinion. And not at all claiming it's the right opinion, okay? I ask the same questions. There's a couple points. Maybe opinion's not the right word. One thing that Lama Zopa Rinpoche said, very helpful for me, you've probably heard this, with people dying, is that you can medicate for pain, but you cannot medicate for suffering. So the way I interpret that is, if you're going to have to medicate, which people are in too much pain sometimes. Then you medicate the pain to the point where, but if you start having them, you know, go unconscious and go to sleep, you know, which can happen, you know, of course you can medicate to that level. But he is saying, well, that level is not helpful. Okay. Again, depends on the client, on the family or the person. You can't assert your, you know, we can't assert our values on them if they want to, you know, you've got to be careful. Oh, you, yeah. So,
like, I don't want that stuff anymore.
Yeah, but that's right. So if you can be in pain, let's just say it's a painful death, okay, because we don't know. If you can be in pain without losing control of your mind, then that's a better way to go. If the pain, for most of us, the pain gets so strong and excruciating, whatever, that we, our minds go berserk and we get totally obsessed with the pain. It may be better than medicate some of the pain. But finally, it does, I don't really know quite how it works, but in terms of what we're really concerned about is the rebirth.
Right.
Yeah. And that's why we don't euthanize animals and things like that in general. Because, anyway, so, for humans, I guess, it often says that your last thought is the throwing karma, the throwing imprint that throws you into your next rebirth. I have some questions about that because as I described earlier, the gross minds absorb pretty early in the death process, and thought is usually concerned with the gross mind. So it's long before you actually die. So I'm not sure what they mean by your last thought. I'm just being honest with you. I have to find out. I used to just accept it. Oh, yeah, yeah. But then when I studied it more, and it's like you look at the process, the gross mind's absorbed first, and like I said, thought is mostly have to do with that. Maybe it's one of those last thoughts that carries over to the time when you die, and then it throws you into your rebirth. That karma is very unique, by the way. It only happens once to a human. It's right when you die. That karma doesn't function any other time. It's called a throwing karma, projecting karma.
And a very subtle mind can stay in the body after
yes.
you die.
I mean, it does stay in the body after you. I mean.
Medication doesn't matter as much.
Well, that's another thing. But you want to try and maintain awareness. You want to maintain awareness throughout the process. See, the yogi is aware through all that. Because he's meditating from the point of view of the subtle mind or a very subtle mind. He's not meditating from the gross mind. His awareness is from the subtle mind. Okay, so he's just watching that process of absorptions and dissolution. But I just don't understand this thing about the last thought. I have to find out about that.
Maybe it's the last thought of the very subtle mind.
Well, the subtle mind is not really thinking at that level. But I think it may be also for maybe just generally people, you know, the absorptions happen so quickly that they, you know, when the gross minds absorb and then they go into the subtle mind, so it might happen within just a few minutes. So maybe it is the last thought of the gross mind. Let's find out. No one knows.
And with all the training and meditation on death, then if you've done that practice leading up to your death.
So if you've done the practice leading up to your death of a lot of meditation on
yes.
death, then maybe you're more prepared to have a better throwing karma.
Oh, you would.
Yeah.
That's the idea. But you have to be also careful because just like you might be a good meditator, unless you're very advanced,
yeah.
but a little bit advanced, which is good. I mean, you know, it's a little bit advanced is very advanced in one way. But a little bit advanced, there's a level of advancing that we can still have a bad thought come in or someone can, you know, get angry by accident. Even though we might be very trained and we don't get angry anymore for the most part. If you haven't gotten rid of all the seeds, it's possible that seed could ripen. At the time of death. That's why you don't shake the body, don't have people crying around the body, don't have people angry. You know, you try and control the environment so in case you're not activating one of those imprints for that person or helping that imprint being activated. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay? Thank you very, very much for hanging in there. Now we'll see you maybe next time. And we'll just for a moment, are you going to dedicate or shall I dedicate?
Let's start first with a short mandala offering. We offer mandalas both to request teachings and in thanks for teachings.
Mm.
And on the bottom of page 97, we'll just do the first verse of the short mandala offering. Sāshī pūkī jūkṣīng mē tōk trāṁ rī rāb līng shī nī
other dedication prayers. Page 36.
At the top of the page, Gewa Dinur Dudag Lama Sange Drum Kyur Ne Drowa Chikyang Malupa Dei Sala Gupar Shok Jang Chub Sem Chok Rinpoche Ma Ke Panam Ke Gyur Chik Ke Wa Nyam Pa Me Pa Yang Gong ne gong tu pel war shok.
In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who service the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And Karuna, on behalf of Kadampa Center and all our community here, we thank you for leading this wonderful workshop and the other sessions that you've taught at, and we hope you will come again.